Okay, big thank you to Tunku Zain Abidin, okay, as the chair, and also like to thank Mr. Ali Salman, okay, from the Islam and Liberty Network, for giving me a chance to address this conference, and also for giving me the shortest title, I believe, for the whole conference. My title just contains two words: non-violent extremism. That's all. Okay, if I were given the chance to add something, I'll probably add non-violent Islamist extremism. Okay, since we are dealing with Islam and Islamism in this conference. Okay, next, please. Okay, on the left there, on the right rather, you see a very important book published earlier this year, edited by Orofino and Alton from the University of East Anglia and Leeds in the UK. My chapter is in there on Malaysia. This is one reference. Okay, and another important reference which I published also earlier this year is a journal article entitled Islamist Responses to the Taliban Takeover in Afghanistan, published in a journal called Politics, Religion and Ideology. If you are an academy obsessed with journal rankings, this is a Q1 Web of Science journal, but only academics will understand what I'm saying. Okay, now some parts of this presentation are excerpted, okay, from those two articles which I co-authored with my former PhD students, and these are basically the parts of my paper, Defining Nonviolent Extremism, Imposing CVE, Caveat, and the gist of this presentation will be CVE or CNVE. Okay, are we to counter violent extremism or countering nonviolent extremism? And a bit on my chapter on ISMA, which is contained in this book. Next, please. Okay, if we look at Islamism, basically the core idea of Islamism is that it's a political ideology rather than a religious faith per se. We can refer to Bassam Tibi's Islamism and Islam, for instance. So there are two core themes in Islamism there, which is the Islamic State, not ISIS, but the concept of the Islamic State, okay, and the implementation of the Sharia. And then I also define extremism here, where extremism conceives politics from a supremacist point of view, the one mentioned by Dr. Iqbal just now, thus demarcating boundaries between in-group and out-group categories of people, meaning giving Muslims or people of certain Muslim orientation better treatment, better status than others, and worse still if there's a takfiri attitude, okay, the attitude which excommunicates other Muslims to the extent that in the extreme situation, Muslims who commit murtad, okay, or leave the region can be killed. Okay, when in power, extremists tend to become intolerant and oppressive towards the other. This is another sociological concept where the other, the concept of othering other individuals or other groups who are not considered part of the mainstream, okay, or the definitive people of a particular country, state, etc. Next, please. So, if you look at Orofino and Alton's the introduction, you'll see that non-violent extremism, they also define as vocal extremism. It is extremism that comes out from one's mouth, orally, verbally. And why is non-violent extremism dangerous? In fact, I would say that it's even more dangerous than violent extremism. Why? Because it's non-violent. That's the very reason why it's more dangerous. But people don't seem to think that it's violent. So much so that if you look into the research done on extremism, it's wholly or mostly A great majority of the research is focused on violent extremism. Hardly anything has been written on non-violent extremism until this book came out. So why is non-violent extremism dangerous? It's a conveyor belt to violent extremism. This is called the slippery slope argument. It can encourage that particular person to commit violence later, perhaps not now. It encourages others to commit violent extremism. Preachers, for instance, who preach supremacist ideologies, they themselves don't commit violent extremism, but others do. Others who listen to their speeches, to their preachings. And the other one is often overlooked by government policymakers. So much so that some researchers have written that non-violent extremism and violent extremism is actually two sides of the same coin. It's supremacist. Okay, it has a lot of problems conceptually. Okay, but one advocates violence, but one does not. Okay, so even there's a quotation here from Orofino and Alton. What unifies extremism, both vocal and violent, is their rejection of pluralism. Legal rules, the economic, political, religious, and social system, they live within. So it's a rejectionist attitude, and this defines the attitude of both violent and non-violent extremists. And non-violent extremists, sometimes we disregard the attention to it just for the fact that they do not advocate violence. Okay? Next, please. And I think this research on non-violent extremism is very important in the case of Malaysia, because if you look at this country in Malaysia, it's considered an anomaly. Which the degree of violence is very, very low, but the degree of extremism is high. Okay, there are some figures I'll show you later, and this I attribute to various factors, for instance, the Sufi influence, a high degree of acceptance of pluralism, so much so that the right-wing parties from Gerakan Tanah Air, I think, led by Mahathir Mohamad in last elections lost. Okay, and there's also high extremism, but low terrorism. Okay, so I quote here from Francis Lokowa, who's a well-known political scientist in Malaysia, already retired from USM, that Malaysia stands out as an aberration. Okay, in this article written in 2010, he draws out a general picture of violence in Malaysia and how it has changed throughout the years. Next, please. So this is a caveat that I'm not saying that violent extremism is not a threat. In fact, it's very dangerous. And I've spoken about violent extremism in many occasions, in many gatherings. This is one of it, a webinar organized by University of Malaysia Sarawak, where I was visiting professor. Next, please. Okay, some reports in Malaysian newspapers, in The Star, 2016, and then in Ipoh Eko, 2018. Next, please. In The Star again, okay, there's me over there, Chandra Muzaffar, Zamir Ahmad Zain, and Ashraf Wazidi. Okay, Ashraf Wazidi was basically saying then, he was then Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department, that there's no Salafi influence in government administration. I was saying a different thing, and this is based on my monograph on Salafization of Malaysian Islam. Next, please. In a Chinese newspaper, in Malaysia. Next, please. Okay, if you look at this off-quoted graph, you see the rates of extremism based on support for ISIS in Malaysia is in number 4. That means the extremist rate is very high, but the instance of terrorism is very low. This is what I call anomaly. So the main problem of extremism in Malaysia is actually non-violent extremism, not violent extremism. Okay, in Malaysia is in fact, the support for ISIS, based on percentage of population, is even higher than Indonesia. Despite we know that the occurrence, terrorist occurrences in Indonesia is much higher. Next, please. Okay, so peculiarity of Malaysian case, I argue that it has not given a due. As a result, most research on extremism, terrorism in Malaysia focuses on violent extremism. And now we are having a problem in this country, which if you look at newspaper reports on 25th August, Anwar Ibrahim, Prime Minister, was saying that we're having an extremist problem, a problem of extremism, which is largely non-violent extremism. And yet, where is the research which supports this? Hardly any. Okay, because people are focusing on violent extremism. But we are facing in this country non-violent extremism. Two articles as well. Next, please. Okay, so CVE or CNVE. I would say that we should have concentrated a long time ago on CNVE, looking at how research has been developing in this country. But because of problems associated, for instance, with global Islamophobia, and then with the uncritical acceptance of Western formula by local institutions and researchers who depend on grants from Western, mostly Western agencies, funding agencies and so on, who impose a particular agenda of CVE, countering violent extremism. So most research done in this country, okay, has not actually attacked the accurate goalposts. And I mentioned also here the disciplinary bias in favor of data-driven empirical political science methods. This has led to a securitization of this terrorism or violence subject until most of them are political scientists, I would say. Okay, and I would say that most of them neglect history, sociology, anthropology to the extent that now we get a very skewed picture or research on extremism in this country. We have neglected research on non-violent extremism. Okay, and I would also say that I myself have experience, okay, doing research on extremism, but not finding any particular terrorist nodes and networks. And the funding agency refused to publish our results just because of that. So that's actually a neo-colonial aspect to this research done on violent extremism and terrorism as well. As if the situation in Malaysia is the same as in other countries. But I would say that it's very much different. Okay, next please. Okay, so I would also refer you to this article written by Kevin Fernandez, whom we're very, very proud of, PhD from USM, and a non-Muslim academic who wrote this article in Suvarnabhumi. This journal article, Suvarnabhumi, is the Korean Journal of Southeast Asian Studies. Let me just read to you from his abstract. Local institutions and researchers in Malaysia may have assumed the Faustian bargain by agreeing with the Western narrative that Islam's teachings promote violence and extremism. That particular agenda imposing that I was mentioning just now. And what does he conclude? United States, through various institutions such as the Department of State, the University of Washington and others, had collaborated with institutions within key ministries in Malaysia to create, disseminate, and propagate narratives in support of the GWOT, Global War on Terror. So neo-colonialism in research on violence and terrorism. Next, please. Okay, so this is just a bit on my chapter in Arafun and Alton. I won't dwell on this because I'm short of time. Next, please. Next, okay. So just my concluding remarks. In confronting extremist challenge, developing and Muslim countries need to prioritize local indigenous resources, categories, themes, strategies, strengths, narratives. Okay, unfortunately, I think that the situation in this country remains a lot to be desired, and most of the research done in this country is good towards a particular conception which is favored by Western agencies, Western governments, or Western funders. Governments accept that USA's fumbling in Iraq and Afghanistan has rendered GWOT meaningless, especially after the mistakes committed, human rights mistakes mostly, in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Okay? And I would like to quote also from Asma Asfaruddin. This is from 2003. That means the quote is 20 years old. You can look at that link where there's a dialogue between four scholars and the Department of State. And what was Asma Asfaruddin saying? Our, i.e. USA's failure has been in not being able to reframe the terms of this discourse in terms that are meaningful to Muslims living in the Islamic world. And despite that, 20 years has passed, after Iraq, after Afghanistan, the situation remains basically the same. Next, please. Okay, that's all. Then, thank you.